Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two segments scheduled for today, one mostly politics, the other mostly economics. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk about the state of American conservatism on the ropes or merely power napping. Our guests will be Corey Robin, who teaches politics at Brooklyn College, and Ryan Salam, a young writer tipped as one of the right's rising stars. Corey is one of the few people on the left who studies right-wing thinking seriously. He's got a very interesting piece on the topic in the June 23 issue of The Nation. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Tom Mackle, chair of the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond and author of When the Good Pensions Go Away, just out from Wiley. He'll talk about the dwindling pension coverage of the American workforce, the dearth of private savings, and our general financial unreadiness for retirement, whether we're 25 or 55. Before we get to all that, a few words on the economic news. Sorry to say, it's mostly more of the same this week. The U.S. economy continues to stumble along, and inflation continues to be a big concern. Two pieces of data came out on Thursday morning suggesting that the U.S. economy was stabilizing, though hardly poised for takeoff. The Labor Department reported that first-time claims for unemployment insurance fell by 5,000 in the week ending June 14, after rising by 27,000 the previous week. The four-week moving average, which is really the best way to look at these volatile numbers, has been roughly flat over the last month, however, suggesting that the job market is no longer deteriorating, but that it's not bounding back to health either. And the Conference Board released its leading indicators for May, a series designed to forecast turns in the economy several months ahead. It rose by a hair for the second consecutive month after having fallen pretty steadily for most of 2007 and early 2008. Same interpretation here as with the jobless claims, steadying into stagnation. This supports what I've been saying here for some time. While the U.S. economy is probably in recession, the more important story is that it's likely to be stagnant to troubled for a year or two or three. The U.S. economy is experiencing not only this stagnation, but rising inflationary pressures. Much of the rest of the world is experiencing the inflation without the stagnation. The head of the Brazilian Central Bank, where inflation is pushing 6%, told the Financial Times that there should be a concerted global push against inflation. Most central banks target a single short-term interest rate as their principal policy instrument, and other short-term rates usually move more or less in tandem with the policy changes. Generally, as interest rates rise, economic activity slows and vice versa, though the relationship isn't perfect. Brazil's central bank has raised its target rate by a full percentage point over the past couple of months. It's now at 12.25%. With inflation close to 6%, that means that the real short-term interest rate is around 6%. In the U.S., our policy rate, the Fed funds rate, is 2%, and inflation is around 4%, meaning a real policy rate of minus 2%. That's quite low by historical standards. Brazil's 6% real rate is quite high. Other central banks around the world, particularly in Europe and Asia, seem to share Brazil's concerns. Our Federal Reserve is talking tough, though earlier in the week they made an effort to leak to the press that they don't want to come off as too hostile. But despite that tough talk, they're reluctant to push interest rates higher because our economy and financial system remain weak and vulnerable to shocks. This is rather a strange situation to be in. Another strange aspect of the current conjuncture, as they say around New Left Review, is that the U.S. is no longer in a position to lecture foreigners about how to run economic policy. The Chinese, once the recipient of patronizing instructions from U.S. officials and pundits on the need to deregulate everything in sight, are now turning the tables and lecturing us on the sloppiness of our economic and financial practices. They're right, of course. It's nice to see Uncle Sam with his mouth taped shut for a change, though God knows how long this will last. And let's close with this, from an article in Wednesday's New York Times, on how foreign investors are looking for alternatives to China now that wages and other costs are rising sharply there. Among the top alternatives, Vietnam, quoth the Times. Vietnam's biggest selling point for many companies is its political stability. Like China, it has a nominally communist one-party system that crushes dissent, keeps the military under tight control, and changes government policies and leaders slowly. Communism means more stability, said Mr. Xu, the chief financial officer of Texhong, a Chinese textile company, voicing a common view among Asian executives who make investment decisions. At least a few American executives agree, although they never say so on the record. That's the end of the quote from the Times. There you have it. The best regime for the capitalist is a communist regime. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the right. And that's some of Satyagraha, mangling the pronunciation of that, I'm sure, a piece by Philip Glass performed by Bruce Brubaker, my neighbor of many years. I've heard him performing that outside the window, and here it is available on recording. Three records that Bruce Brubaker has put out, Philip Glass, Alvin Curran, and John Adams, and John Cage. He is the master of minimalist piano. And we're now joined in the studio by Corey Robin, and we have on the line Ryan Salam, and we want to talk about conservatism. Corey has a piece in the review in the what issue of The Nation is that? It is the June 23rd issue of The Nation. A review of several books, but it's also an opportunity to talk about American conservatism in a systematic way. And my first topic of interest at the moment is, Corey, it does seem at times like American conservatism is right now on the ropes. It had a great run for 25, 30 years, and now it's looking like it's lost some popularity, lost coherence, lost its enthusiasm. Is that a fair perception?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, many conservatives say that themselves, so I don't think that's a perception that's coming from the outside. There was a piece in The New Yorker recently by George Packer where you had several leading conservative thinkers and activists making exactly that claim. And I think the reason why conservatism is on the ropes is because it has been so successful. Historically, the task of conservatism, going back to the French Revolution, but certainly true of the recent American version of conservatism, the task has always been to mobilize against a insurgent movement from the left, a movement that was trying to democratize society in some way, shape, or form. Now, those movements change over time, and the objects of democratization change over time, but that's what they're always about, and that's what conservatism has always saw as its fundamental task to do, to essentially roll back that movement. And the modern American conservative movement has been fairly successful in doing so, certainly in the economic sphere, and to a lesser degree in some of the realms of the family and race relations. But that it's, I think, a symptom of its success that it is now sort of flailing about and trying to cast about for what is its task, what is its role, because its enemy, its historic enemy, has been just decimated for the last however many decades.
But also a movement that thrives in outsiderhood. Once it runs all branches of government for a period of time, can no longer credibly claim to be the outsiders, can they? I mean, I noticed, you turn on Fox News and there's still this mythology of the dominant liberal elite, and they're boldly fighting the good fight. But that's kind of hard to believe, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it is one of the great ironies of conservatism that it is a movement of elites or sometimes displaced elites, and what's interesting about them is that unlike previous ruling classes, you might say, the conservatives, again, going back to the French Revolution, they rest their claim to power and legitimacy on precisely the fact that they have been victimized. And this is a very peculiar argument for a ruling class to make, not only because it is a ruling class, but also because it's not exactly the kind of heroic, forceful argument for power that one would have thought that they would make. I argue that the reason that they do that is the sort of political currency or the vocabulary that the left has created, going back again to the 18th century, and that conservatives, either in an instrumental fashion, in a Machiavellian way, cribbing the language, or sometimes somewhat subconsciously, not even understanding where they're getting it from, have to speak this language of victimization and outsiderhood, and that is the key to their power. I call it the sort of the fusion of the pariah and power. And that's how they make their claims.
Now, you had you on here about 6 or 7 years ago. You had a piece in perhaps the final issue of Lingua Franca, or one of the final issues of Lingua Franca, in which you talked to several conservatives, Irving Kristol and William F. Buckley among them, both of whom confessed that that conservatism isn't exactly an inspiring doctrine.
Yeah.
I think Buckley said it was as dull as sex, which is a very strange thing to say, but that's the old Catholic for you, I guess. And I think Kristol said, if you want a political philosophy, look at Marxism. Were they just the avant-garde of this recognition?
I think in a certain way they were. I remember when that piece came out, it got really attacked by an awful lot of younger conservatives, people like Jonah Goldberg and some of the other folks at National Review, saying, what are you guys talking about? you know, this movement is, you know, is thriving. And in a way, you know, we're just in the first year of the Bush administration. But these guys, I think, really did. I mean, they were very clear. They saw that the writing was on the wall, that the movement was just in abeyance or heading into that, and that the Bush administration was that first term was really the last gasp. And in fact, I made the argument at the time after 9/11, my only bit of political prophecy that I've ever been proven correct, that the sort of the heyday of the Bush administration after 9/11 was really very similar to what the post 1964 election of Lyndon Johnson. It seems like it's the apex of power for that regime, but it's in fact the beginning of the beginning of the end. And these guys, Crystal and Buckley, the older guys, they understood it because the raison d'etre of the movement had really disappeared.
I thought it was interesting that one of McCain's strategists said the other day that Barack Obama is exhibiting a September 10th mentality. It seems like these guys are just stuck in a September 12th mentality. They haven't moved on either.
Yeah.
We are joined on the line by someone who is identified as perhaps one of the great young hopes of conservative intellectuals, Rehan Salam. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Rehan Salam, that's right.
Rehan Salam. You are a contributor to the website The American Scene and a fellow at the New America Foundation. Do you have any reactions to what Corey was saying?
I think that what Corey is saying is very interesting. He's a thinker that I very much admire. I do think that he's conflating a lot of different tendencies and that the reactionary mode is something that doesn't exist exclusively on the political right. I also think that when you look at, you know, the American intellectual tradition, I think that you see a lot of confusing curlicues. For example, a figure like William Jennings Bryan, he was, you know, a populist. He was an egalitarian, and that's precisely why he, for example, opposed the idea of Darwinian evolution. I think he was wrong in that regard. And today there is a left that, you know, is in some respects very secular, in some respects embraces Darwinian evolution and identifies itself with the spirit of scientific inquiry. I think that's a very good, very positive development for the left and also for our broader society. But again, I mean, you know, a lot of those strains are now found on the political right. A lot of those strands that, you know, we think of as know-nothingism. So, I mean, you know, was he a conservative? Was he a reactionary? Was he a leftist? It's not clear to me that, you know, it makes very much sense to think of him in these ways. And I also think that when you look at the political right in the United States, I think that actually Corey gets something very right when he says that conservatism has been exhausted because of its success. But again, the conservatism that he's talking about, is it this ancient, unbroken tradition that stretches back to the 18th century, or is it, like progressivism, a response to a particular discrete set of questions and concerns? If you were born in 1885, and David Frum has introduced this idea that I think is very insightful, you know, the kind of problems that you encountered in American life, the corruption of the cities, the challenge of assimilating a large foreign-born population, and a variety of other things, also the extremes of poverty and wealth, some issues that we're actually encountering today, albeit in different form, were things that would lend itself to a kind of, kind of elitist cultural tendency united with a belief in strong government intervention, a kind of public paternalism. But then by the time you had the encounter with totalitarianism in Europe, then liberalism reconceived itself, moving away from public paternalism to a strong anti-paternalism. David Sibley has written about this pretty intelligently, I think. So I think that these tendencies change. I think that, we call something conservatism or we call it liberalism, but it means something very different in, say, 1900 or 1950 or 2000. And I think that it's really true that the conservative tendency that emerged as part of this kind of anti-paternalist turn has in some respects exhausted itself, and we're going to have a new set of challenges and questions, and we're going to have a new set of political ideologies. But we're right now in a very uncertain period. So that's my own perhaps idiosyncratic take on the same set of issues.
Now, I remember my days as a conservative back at the Party of the Right at Yale in the early 1970s, a brief moment of inhabiting that end of the spectrum. The big battle was between traditionalists and libertarians, between people who believed in hierarchy and religion and received wisdom, and people who believed in the ceaseless revolutionary power of the market, almost a Marxist understanding of the revolutionary power of capitalism. Does that debate still exist? There was talk that Reagan was able to bring those two strands together, and once he was gone, they've sort of drifted apart. What's the state of that disunion?
I absolutely think that's a real tension, and that's one of the reasons why I think that actually a figure who underlies a lot of the intellectual change happening on both the left and on the right is Christopher Lash. He was, you know, a very quirky figure, as you guys know, who, you know, was someone who defended later in his life the populist tradition, the tradition of the organic tradition of the lower middle class. And I think that that's something you see, you know, when Barack Obama talks about empowering communities, when he talks about the bitterness of the working class, I don't think he was actually being unfair. I don't think he was being derisive. I think that he was talking about something very real, a real sense of disempowerment. Daniel Bell described himself as a conservative in culture, a liberal in politics, and a socialist in economics. And I think that that, you know, kind of constellation of views that seems, you know, strange in terms of these, you know, Bush-era political categories actually has a lot of resonance with real people. So I think that you're going to see a lot of change in both political parties where, for example, the Republicans might embrace greater government interventionism. They already have this hard-edged cultural egalitarianism that might become linked to certain kinds of economic egalitarianism, perhaps. And at the same time, when you're looking at the political left, you know, Corey Robin wrote another wonderful piece called Endgame for the Boston Review, and he talked about the split between the neoconservative right and the new American business class, which is very global in its orientation. And I think that actually has, you know, in some respects, a pretty attractive moral sensibility, but also some would argue a level of indifference toward the fate of the American working class. So I think that when you're talking about the elite, it's not obvious that it's entirely a neoliberal pro-market elite. You know, that's certainly a very important current. That's a very important strand. But I think that they also have other priorities, other cultural priorities, including a cultural cosmopolitanism that, you know, complicates the picture very much. And so that's why I actually think you've seen a break between, you know, political conservatism of the Reagan-Bush mold and, you know, many segments of the American elite. So when, you know, conservatives engage in this tiresome anti-elitism, they actually are responding to something real in the world. That's not necessarily the most salient thing, and I do think that that, you know, is actually, you know, not always a very healthy intellectual tick. But, I mean, I'm just suggesting that the picture is actually pretty darn complicated because, you know, Americans are pretty complicated people.
That was the voice of Riad Salam and Corey Robin, Brooklyn College and author of a piece in The Nation on the state of conservatism today. You were making some skeptical faces during that commentary. What were you thinking?
Well, there's a couple of responses that I had. I mean, there's certain areas that I certainly agree with what Ryan has said. But what I would say is that the reactionary element of conservatism doesn't cut across the board. And when I talk about its reactionary element, I'm not referring to its cultural conservatism. For example, I mean something very specific, which is that the moments when conservatism as a movement, not as a kind of doctrine of a couple of intellectuals, but as a real full-blown movement, and I think there have been three great sort of waves of conservatism in America. The first is the defense of slavery in the Old South, and then the sort of reconstruction of slavery in Jim Crow. That's the first. The second is the defense of big business during the Gilded Age, and then the third is the sort of long conservative movement from the early 1950s to its culmination under Reagan. Those are the three, and the reactionary element of those movements is that they are defending very concrete relations of power and very particular regimes. In the slave plantation, the workplace, the family. These are the sort of the this is the triptych of conservatism in this country. So it's absolutely true that there's other elements of secularism and religion and all the rest of it that float around that. It's absolutely correct that these kind of take different forms and different constellations. But I think if you focus on these regimes of inequality, I think that's where conservatism really gets its traction and its ideas kind of flow, you know, not to be too much of a vulgar Marxist as it is, but they flow out of that.
But they've managed to create and prevail or preside over a period of tremendous inequality, rivaling the first Gilded Age. And now that they've accomplished their goal, can they shuffle off, or are they going to defend it?
I think what's going to happen is you're starting to see the beginnings of some kind of a progressive movement that's going to try to dismantle this. It's going to probably, you know, take a certain amount of years for that movement to really come to fruition and have a kind of genuine realigning election. I don't think this election is going to be that election. And then you'll see conservatism reinvent itself. I think that Raihan is absolutely right, is that it does reinvent itself in different circumstances, in different contexts, and that's where you get its tremendous syncretism on the one hand, its ability to draw from these very disparate currents, which he's absolutely correct about, and its intellectual creativity and fertility on the other hand. But it will be in response to an insurgent movement of the left that has set to sort of democratize, and I think, you know, relations particularly, again, in the workplace, which is, I think, where you've seen the sort of the great new inequalities that have been emerging. And I think Ryan is right to be worried about that and talk about these working class, conservative constituencies, because that is going to be the key constituency that they're going to try to win over. I just don't believe that the right has a program that is going to be able to do that for the next couple of decades.
Ryan Salaam, what do you make of Corey's argument that, first of all, that conservatism thrives in outsiderhood and must present itself as some kind of victim, but you know, second, that it really is thrives in defending these very substantial hierarchies of power, the examples that he mentioned?
I think it's an interesting idea, certainly. I just don't see the same continuity. I think that when you're talking about the regime of enslavement, it happened before the age of mass politics as we understand it. I think that it actually is very hard to draw those connections. And I can see why, you know, one who sees himself as part of a kind of broadly progressive, positive intellectual tradition would want to characterize it as such. My own view is that, you know, even when you look at, say, the New Deal included a number of currents, a number of conservative currents as well as currents of what we would characterize as the progressive left. Consider that, you know, during the 1920s, there was a massive challenge to the kind of hierarchies within the family that Corey is describing. For example, the patriarchy. You had a large number of women entering the workforce. And part of the project of the New Deal was to enforce, this idea of the family wage, was to actually reverse the tide of women who entered the workforce. And so, you know, was this a kind of reactionary effort to kind of strengthen old hierarchies? Was it an appeal to working class solidarity? Was it paying attention to the, you know, folk traditions of German-born immigrants? And how that, you know, was different from that of native-born Americans. I think there was a lot of different things. And I think that, you know, trying to construct these, you know, kind of organic intellectual solidarities, you know, just I find it potentially misleading. But, you know, I do think that in terms of his broad characterization of this present political moment, I think he's right. I think that the left has a real opportunity, and I think that they ought to be very excited and enthusiastic about that. And I also think it's true that the right is going to have to accommodate itself to the fact that, you know, a lot of the economic changes we see in our society mean that the safety net, the social safety net as provided by the state, is going to have to become more important rather than less in some respects. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we disagree on certain, you know, very fundamental premises, but I think that when it comes to the political landscape, I think we agree on a lot.
How do you imagine conservatism refashioning itself to sell itself to working class, particularly white working class voters? Because, you know, they're on the ropes, economically speaking. The tax cutting message that was so popular in the 80s will have very little appeal. The sense of social disorder and, you know, that was so popular in the 60s and 70s, that doesn't really have much appeal. What's the main selling point of a right-wing ideology to people who are at the bottom half of the income distribution?
Well, I imagine I disagree with you a little bit in terms of, you know, how to characterize the economy of the present. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of things. I think that you're right that, for example, the federal tax burden is far less salient than it used to be. But there are a lot of other costs. You know, for example, the cost of health insurance premiums, a lot of these private sector costs that are, in fact, deeply entangled with the state. And in fact, you know, I'll bet Corey would agree with me that actually, you know, the right often poses as laissez-faire or being for civil society and being for the market, but oftentimes they actually have pursued an aggressive interventionism on behalf of the rich and the powerful. I think that's a very bad, very dangerous tendency. And you do have some on the libertarian right and, you know, some on the populist right who are opposed to those tendencies. And I think that
should they let Bear Stearns go under for libertarian principles?
I honestly can't really say, and I'm reluctant to speak about that just as a, you know, because I think that, you know, my own view is that, you know, you can't take a two principled view. I think that, you know, on Bear Stearns, I think that you need to pay attention to what the repercussions are going to be for the most vulnerable members of our society. But, you know, as to what conservatives can do, I think that actually they have some pretty, you know, appealing messages regarding, for example, parents and their needs. And, you know, a child rearing is something that's become very challenging given the changing nature of the economy. I think that there's a, you know, dense entanglement of things like the price of homes and the quality of schools that are things that conservatives would be smart to address. Actually, my friend and I just wrote a book called Grand New Party that I actually think might be of interest to your audience as well as to conservatives that addresses some of these questions. But, you know, I just think okay. that, you know,
go
it's
ahead,
more
go
than
ahead
nuanced.
Plug the book. What's the title?
Oh, it's called Grand New Party, which is a rather silly title, I know. But you know, it is trying to answer these questions about the future of the welfare state and how conservatives can, you know, be constructive about addressing the needs of the conservative base. Our real concern is that Republicans rely on the votes of working class whites, but they haven't actually been, you know, doing much for them. And we want to correct that.
Corey, any final words?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think Pat Buchanan in the George Packer article had a what I thought was a telling response. I mean, I think that Ryan's solution is interesting, and he's clearly grappling with a problem. But conservatism at its best has not been motivated by an electoral challenge. We want to hold on to the base. We want to hold on. It's been motivated by the real, genuine, and, you know, almost theological horror of real massive efforts at redistributing power. And that has provoked its greatest creativity intellectually and its greatest political salience. So while I think this is an interesting proposal, I think what Pat Buchanan said is that it's essentially an ideological construct. It doesn't really engage the heart, because conservatism is not about the defense of parents in the abstract against some kind of abstract force. It's about the defense of parents against the efforts, against people who want to turn, you know, a world turned upside down, against the efforts of, you know, student radicals trying to empower children or liberal bureaucrats
or
social workers and so forth, or feminists trying to undermine. And I don't say that to disparage it. I mean, that is its great emotive and intellectual strength as a movement. So I suspect that it will not really gain any real traction again until it is confronted by a movement that's really trying to kind of take away that power, not something abstract called the market or something like that.
I think there's something to that.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. So thanks to both of you. Ryan Salaam on the phone, co-author of Grand New Party and blogs on the American scene and a fellow at the New America Foundation. And Corey Robin, professor at Brooklyn College and author of a piece, Out of Place, in the June 23rd issue of The Nation. All right, let's take a break and we'll be back.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
This is WBAI, 99.5 FM on the radio dial and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about pensions. Not a bit of more of Philip Glass, performed by Bruce Brubaker. Mad Rush is the name of that piece. Well, American workers are losing pensions and many, many other things. And my next guest is got a new book out about that topic, When the Good Pensions Go Away, Why America Needs a New Deal for Pension and Healthcare Reform. Thomas Mackel is the author, and the book just out from Wiley. Tom Mackel had an unusual career trajectory, went from working with unions and then got into the investment business, and now is a chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. for a little while longer, chair of the board of directors of the Richmond Fed. And he's very concerned about how most of us are so unready for retirement. So this, an interview recorded a couple of days ago, Tom Mackel. Welcome to Behind the News, Tom Mackel. First of all, let's just lay out the situation. What kind of pension landscape do people face today?
Well, I think it's a very problematic landscape. You know, in 1979, 62% of the workforce were covered by a defined benefit plan. By 2005, that had kind of flipped. 63% of workers are covered by defined contribution plans, and there's only about 17 to 18% of the workforce today covered by defined benefit plans in the private sector. So clearly, defined benefit plans have been eroded over this last 25 years or so when 401k plans came into fruition in 1981. And there's been an initiative on the part of corporate America to do away with that long-term responsibility and place the risk of managing your own money off the shoulders of the institution onto the shoulders of the individual. And clearly, in my judgment, the 401k plan or defined contribution plan as a standalone plan is probably the worst idea on the face of the planet. Because you're asking people who haven't had the luxury of going to the Wharton School of Finance to plan their long-term asset allocation, to pick the stocks and the bonds and the other types of investments for their long-term plan. Now, most people don't have enough money to put into a plan like that. And we're asking them now to, in effect, plan over the next 30 or 40 years or more as to how their money should be managed. CNN did a poll in late February asking the question, how many folks are using their 401k plans to pay their monthly expenses? This was at the end of February. 54%. 54% said that they were. Now, with the full regalia of mortgages being foreclosed, etc., more and more people are dipping into their 401k plans to thwart off mortgage foreclosure. So I suspect that here we are in mid-June, that number, 54%, probably has headed north since then. It's a debacle. In 2005, the average holdings in a 401k plan was $65,000. Now it's down to about $59,000, and it just keeps ratcheting down. People take a loan out of those plans. By and large, 70 to 80% never pay it back. So if you could talk to a 32-year-old and tell that 32-year-old that 10 grand that you pulled out, maybe for a legitimate issue within the family unit, a health care problem for a child and they didn't have proper health care coverage, etc., if they don't put that money back over a 30-year period, $10,000 compounded at 8%, if you're lucky enough to get that today, is $240,000. That's the difference between retiring and not. And most young folks will say, I don't have the money to put it back in there because we're in debt up to our eyeballs in this nation today.
What about this debt problem? You alluded to this several times. A lot of analysts just take a kind of moral approach to it. People are just spending beyond their means and they need to tighten their belts. Is that the problem? Why are people saving so little and borrowing so much?
Well, I think it's a cultural thing. I think that Americans anticipate that 2 or 3 years or 4 years down the road, they're going to be earning more money, when the reality is that may not necessarily be the case. There's also the issue of attempting to keep up with the Joneses. If you look at our culture has been promulgated by corporate America. You may not need this, but you got to have this. And that there, in my judgment, lies in the problem. We have raised an entire generation of Olympic-style, world-class spenders, consumers, who are in the balls, in the shops, constantly buying, and without recognition that at some point in time they have to pay for this. Today in America, the average number of credit cards that an American has is 5. In Brazil, there's a credit card for every 2.5 people. In Russia, there's a credit card for every 6.8 people, I think it is. In China, there's a credit card for every 32.2% of 32.2 people. And in India, it's about 66 people per credit card. I mean, those two societies are going to start to, you know, utilize credit card in a more pervasive fashion as well.
But we need to borrow money from them.
Well, we're borrowing money from them, yes. That's you're absolutely right. But I think what's happened is the mindset of so many young folks is that when their first credit card hits the max and they can't use it any longer, their answer is, let's get a second card. And they never have the ability to pay off the original card. I mean, this whole issue of the government recently issuing a tax rebate of $300 or $600 predicated on the size of the family and your income tax bracket, that money right now is being used to fill the gas tank, or maybe some people are using it to pay off their credit cards. It's not going to do a thing to stimulate our economy. And the wizards in Washington don't get it.
Well, if you put this together, the problems with the 401k plan, the high levels of debt, what are people who are in their 40s or 50s, how are they shaping up to retire in 10 or 20 years?
You know, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the old adage of the three-legged stool of retirement. The three-legged stool of retirement was, one leg was your pension plan, namely a defined benefit. The second leg was your Social Security benefit. And the third leg of the stool was your savings, your individual savings or your family savings. If you look at each one of those, every leg, those three legs, are all fractured in some fashion. They're splinters today. About a week and a half ago, I talked to a young man in his mid-30s, and we were chatting, and he had read my book, and he said, I never heard the term before, the three-legged stool of retirement. So I said, wow. The following Monday, that was on a Friday, the following Monday I spoke to 300 firefighters at a conference. And I looked out over the audience, and before I got into my formal remarks, I saw that a good deal of them looked like they were under 40 years of age. And so I said, by a show of hands, how many in the room understand or know what the three-legged stool of retirement is? 300 people, 12 hands went up. Today I was talking to the publicist at the John Wiley Company, and I asked her the question. She's a young lady who's probably in her late 20s. She said, I never heard of that before. So people aren't thinking about their long-term retirement, or they think that it's such a cumbersome issue today that they're not dealing with it. And they'll say, oh, I'll deal with that later. So they're pushing it off and pushing it off, like Congress has been pushing off the need to take a serious look at our entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security. Because if we don't get those right, they will gobble up our GDP as we go forward. Healthcare today represents about 17% of the GDP. The projections are that healthcare will represent 50% of the GDP by 2025. It's going to gobble up the nation. Medicare benefits, if we don't do a thing, if we maintain the same program, within 20 years, we have to cut the benefits in half. So the younger generation is hard-pressed to understand that they have to be disciplined to save money if they're fortunate enough to go to work for a company where they have an opportunity to sign on to the 401k or defined contribution plan. Therein lies a dilemma, because most people say, I need that extra money. You know, well, I want to buy a beer on the weekend, or I need to buy a suit because I got a new job, or what, or I got to pay for my apartment, my rent, et cetera, et cetera. So the reality is that one out of three, when offered one of those plans, accepts it. I said earlier, 70-80% who take out loans, we should not allow loans in those plans, because people are looking at them not as retirement plans, they're looking at them as forced savings plans. And then this whole issue of, we're going to allow the next generation that may have anywhere from 4 to 8 jobs or whatever in their careers, portability. Well, when I served on the ERISA Advisory Council, we did some data analysis. Back then, this was only a few short years ago, people who left their jobs, primarily younger people, 80 to 90% of them never rolled it over. So the notion of taking it from employer A to employer B to employer C is out the window. Now you take the issue of long-term asset allocation. With all due respect to the American population, most people don't understand the difference between a stock and a bond. And we're now asking them to plan for their long-term asset allocation, which I think is ludicrous. Again, a statistic. 90% of people, when they select their initial asset allocation, 90% of them never change it. So a 25-year-old in the workforce early on decides that he or she wants a higher exposure to equities, 70%, and 30% to fixed income or fixed income-like investments, never change their asset allocation. As markets change, and they're not sophisticated enough to understand the dynamics of markets, when you should be in, when you should be out, and when I'm not suggesting that people time the markets, but the reality is lifestyles change, responsibilities change, the dynamics of the markets change, and people are ill-prepared to make those kinds of decisions. When you look at the professional investment management community on Wall Street, 79% of managers over the last 10 years have failed to beat their bogey, whatever their index is, for the kinds of stocks or bonds they're managing. 79% of them don't outperform the bogey. So how do we expect, you know, a guy who's driving a truck or a plumber or a waiter or an office worker or someone who hasn't had that kind of serious financial training to manage their money? It's a task that is a monumental task. And this country, unfortunately, is in financial illiteracy that is off the charts. And I say to people who are influential in their communities, I don't care what state you come from and what the political persuasion is of the legislators in your state, whether they're way over on the left or the way over on the right. No one can disagree with the notion that we ought to mandate by law financial education starting in kindergarten and running up through grade school to teach kids about pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters, what's a bank, what's a bank account, what's a credit card, what's debt, I mean, this is an iteration over a period of time, what's compound interest, because the world that these youngsters are going to be inheriting is dictated by finance, and if they don't understand finance, they're finished with.
I'll speak with Tom Mackle, who is the author of When the Good Pensions Go Away, Why America Needs a New Deal for Pension and Healthcare Reform, just out from Wiley. Okay, so let's turn to the what is to be done about this situation. Shifting the American household from spending to savings would be a major change. It would also be a major economic disruption. We've got 70% of the economy is consumption. How do we get from here to there?
Well, that to me is an extremely serious challenge. We have to make a quantum leap in beginning to educate people about the issue of debt. And yeah, people are going to spend, and they need things, and they have to buy things, you know, for their everyday lives, etc. But I think we've got to somehow reevaluate the kinds of things that people think they need, that they must have, when in reality they don't have to. So we're going to have to start to change our thinking about, well, do we really need 5 TVs in a house? Do we really need 3 cars in a garage? Do we really need all of these extra kinds of things that have fired up the nation's economy? No question about it. But I think we have to really begin to think about how the world has changed and how America is going to be a different kind of country going forward from an economic perspective, because you look at China, you look at India, you look at Brazil, you look at Russia, in a relatively short period of time, their economies are going to be going well beyond ours. And it's a demographic thing in many instances, more than anything else. It's like the pension issue is a demographic issue. I said that Bill Clinton missed an opportunity back a dozen years or so ago. He should have set up a new department of a cabinet level, Secretary of Demography, recognizing that 77 million baby boomers would be retiring over the next 15 to 20 years, which has a profound effect on the world of work, the world of leisure, the world of healthcare, the world of healthcare infrastructure and delivery of healthcare benefits, and we're ill-prepared for that. Not to mention the immigrants that are out there that have to be somehow embraced in this economy of ours and paid a decent wage so that they can pay their taxes, they can be legalized, etc., can contribute to the system for Social Security, etc., that we've got another 61 million Generation Ys coming up right behind, or Xs coming up right behind them, and another 80 million of Generation Ys behind them. And these kids are already saddled with pervasive debt in terms of college tuitions, etc. I mean, kids starting out their lives with a deep hole of debt. we've got to somehow begin to re-educate people on what debt is and how destructive it can be for an individual's life. More and more people are going into bankruptcy. That requires a tremendous education. In terms of looking at the pension systems themselves, we've got to step back and be a little bit more creative and innovative. As a nation, we have had historically the ability to be challenged by serious issues, you know, whether it was the Great Depression or World War II, and to fashion policies that enabled us to climb out of those debacles and get our nation back moving in the right track. During the post-Depression, post-World War II era, the captains of industry, significant labor leaders and governmental leaders at Treasury, Commerce, and Labor, and their minions would meet on an ongoing basis to discuss what was tantamount to our nation's national industrial policy. It died in Jimmy Carter's administration, never to be resuscitated again. Had we continued, in my judgment, that kind of an ongoing dialogue with those tripartite approach, I think we as a nation would be better off dealing with globalization today, because people would have recognized the problems that they would create if they did this or they did that. And maybe in a room where there's intelligent discussion, we could turn that baby around in some fashion. I think that we've got to rethink retirement plans.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I did want to ask you what it's like for a guy with a labor background like yours inside the pinnacle of the establishment, the Federal Reserve. How do they relate to you? How do you relate to them?
Well, it's been a fascinating experience. I mean, I truly have learned a great deal, interfaced with some very, very bright and dedicated people. My experience with the Fed itself is that every person, every point of contact, from the guy who meets you at the hotel to take you over to the Fed building for a meeting, et cetera, to the presidents of the various banks. And one of the things I said to the then president of the bank when I first went on, I said, you know, a lot of people want to go and visit baseball stadiums. I don't have an interest in doing that. I'd like to visit every Fed bank during my six-year term. And he said, you let me know when you're going to be in this town or that town where a bank is. So I've seen eight of them. Next week I'm going to Philadelphia, which will be my ninth. And before now and the end of the year, I will have visited all 12. And you get to meet the president of the bank, and then they call back and they say, what is this guy interested in? They say, well, he's interested in pension issues, world of work issues, healthcare issues, outsourcing, offshoring, Latin America, et cetera. So I get involved with economists who are studying various things, and it's a great dialogue for me. My responsibility on the board is to gather anecdotal information, as each director does, and give a 5 to 8 minute presentation predicated on anecdotal information every month. So I talk to people who are on the ground, who talk about issues that I'm really concerned about, that I want to bring to the attention of the Federal Reserve Bank, to be, you know, someone who has a deep concern about working Americans. You know, I used to have a sign on the wall in my office that said, if you don't make dust, you eat dust. And I'm of the mind now that too many Americans are getting dust kicked in their face, and we've got to turn this baby around. So I try to articulate those kinds of concerns. Working with the economists, I mean, there's some very, very smart people in the system. Occasionally, you've got to lasso them around the ankle and bring them down to earth to talk about real-life issues, et cetera, because some of them are, you know, brilliant folks, a little bit esoteric in terms of the things that they're focusing on. And I try to bring people down to speak at our dinners, you know, the head of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, to tell them, like it is, the kinds of pension funds that are in serious condition today, or other folks in the healthcare arena and some of the other areas where I have a keen interest, where I think these people should be more sensitized to, if you will. And so that's part of a mission that I've had for my 5.5 years now on the board. And it's been an exhilarating experience. I'm off at the end of the year. I'll miss that dialogue, but I can step away with knowing that I made somewhat of a contribution, and also that the people, some of the people, really listened and try to respond to certain things that I've raised. You know, it's a behemoth organization. that's moving down the track. It's got monetary policy that's part of its edict. It's got supervision and regulation of the banking system. It's got an outreach responsibility in terms of financial education and just getting out into the community and alerting people as to what the Fed is all about, et cetera. I marvel at the number of people who really don't know what the Fed is or what the Fed does. I had somebody, I was recently going to speak at a pension conference, and the guy said to me, well, you're with a bank now, so when you come to the conference, what are you going to be selling, custodial services? I said, no, this is the Federal Reserve System, you know, founded in 1913 by Congress. But in any event, it's been a fabulous experience. I think people listen. I've been able to go to the Conference of Chairman meetings and make an impact on certain issues and have corporate leaders come up to me after and say, you know, you're absolutely right about this issue or that issue, or I wasn't quite aware of the way you presented it. You make a sound approach to dealing with issues, et cetera. So I feel good about that. You know, in the grand scheme of things, will Mackel's tenure on the board be a blip on the radar screen? Who knows? But I've enjoyed the experience, and it's been very enlightening and very educational for me.
And that was Thomas J. Mackel, Jr., to use his full name. Who not only is chair of the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, but author of the book When the Good Pensions Go Away, just out from John Wiley and Sons. And Tom Mackel has had a say, now it's my turn. He did make a lot of important points about the declining quality of pension coverage and the unreadiness of millions, including me, for a retirement. And he's right that left unchecked, Medicare will bankrupt the government and health care spending will bankrupt us as a nation. But I think the solution to both problems, pensions and health care, is to enlarge the public sector. First, pensions. He's right that people should spend less, borrow less, and save more. The earth would certainly be better off if we did. But one reason that people save so little and borrow so much is that their wages just aren't keeping up with the cost of living. Much of the decline in the savings rate from the 1950s to the 1980s, Americans saved about 8% of their after-tax income. Now it's down to 0%. Much of the decline of that decline has come in the upper brackets, which went from being big savers to big borrowers. People of low and average income have mostly saved little over the years because they spent pretty much everything that came in. That's almost the definition of being working class. And the private pension system can be diabolical. Though the funds are held in the name of workers, they're typically run by professional portfolio managers who pay themselves very, very well and vote the stock under their ownership in the interests of shareholders and not workers. That means squeezing the workforce to fatten profits. Better to expand Social Security and making it more, not less, generous. Forget all the alarmist stuff about how Social Security is going broke. It's not. The U.S. can afford a more generous public pension system, though Wall Street and our official ideologues would not like it. As for health care, the only sensible solution is a single-payer system. It's the only approach that can guarantee both universal coverage and cost control. In our private insurance-dominated system, administrative overhead takes up about a third of all our health care spending. There's nothing else like this in the world. All those other countries with public health insurance systems spend less than we do and cover everyone. Our political discourse is stacked against that solution, but everything else is an abomination. Oh, and call me old-fashioned, but if we are going to teach kids financial literacy, as Tom Mackel proposes, it'd be nice if they'd slip a unit into the curriculum on how to expropriate the bourgeoisie. A guy can dream, can't he? Okay, don't forget the panel on Obama and the Left tonight with Ta-Nehisi Coates, Gary Young, Betsy Reed, Joanne Mort, and me at 7:30 at the Brecht Forum, 451 West Street between Bank and Bethune Streets in Manhattan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with something from a newish album by a band whose name I can't say in full on the radio, the F-Buttons. This is from the first track, Sweet Love for Planet Earth. Sounds like a harder version of Philip Glass. Till next week, bye.